For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
What I thought I would talk about tonight, after talking with Tygon, is a fascicle of Dogen Zenji's called Bodhisattva Shishobo, which is, which I've had the honor and enjoyment of translating with Shohaku Okamura Roshi, and we translated that title as The Bodhisattva's Four Embracing Actions, or Dharmas. And Kaz Tanahashi has it in Munina Dewdrop as The Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. So are most of you kind of long-time students here, or not a long time? You know about Dogen? Yeah.
Mostly.
An uncomfortable laugh. Do you know about anything else? Good, then I don't have to give you the biography. But it's hard to do this in a short period of time, but I'm going to do my best. So, Bodhisattva Shishobo is a fascicle of one of the collections of Shobo Genzo, The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, and it was written in the summer of 1243, and that was really very shortly before Dogen's whole community picked up from the place they had established in Kyoto and moved to these wild mountain forests of Echizen province, which is where he founded what is now Eheji. So we were talking about this afternoon. It's not clear why he moved or how sudden it was, how planned it was, but there's some suggestion of sectarian conflict in the community, among the Buddhist groups in Kyoto, some possibility of violence. It also may have been, as we were talking, he just really had a calling to be in the mountains where Zen was traditionally cultivated in China, and where he wanted to get out. Perhaps he wanted to get away from the cosmopolitan hustle and bustle of Kyoto, which is, we were also discussing the conundrum of studying Dogen and living and practicing here in the midst of a highly cosmopolitan place. I could not help but notice the patter of feet overhead. There's no way to escape from the world. And there wasn't, I don't think, any way to escape from the world even when he went to Echizen province. The world is with us. And those, whatever challenges they are, they come right down the road. So this fascicle is, perhaps it was advice to his community, perhaps advice to himself. It fits in a long tradition of sets of practices that are given to help you figure out how to be present, how to save sentient beings, how to be bodhisattvas. So the title translates bodhisattva, shishobo, shi is four. Sho is what we translated as embracing. This is the closest word that Shohaku-san and I could get to. So, and then bo or ho is dharma. It's also action, and it's also could be what Kaz Tanahashi translated as method. This is an interesting configuration of the title. This is an ancient teaching. I should say, so here, let me just say up front, these four practices are giving, kind speech or gentle speech, beneficial action, and something that we translated from Dogen's very technical terms as identity action, meaning acting in identity with, non-separation from. But actually, this is an old teaching. You'll find these practices well established in the early Buddhist tradition. In the Pali text, there's the Sangaha Sutta, where it's a short sutra in Pali, which the Buddha laid out what he called the Sangaha Vatu, which is translated, interesting, as the foundations for social unity. And you also find it, you find this formulation, although not unpacked, referenced in the Lotus Sutra, in the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutra, in the Vimalakirti Sutra, these same four approaches or four practices. I'm thinking when I practiced at Zuyoji, this Japanese temple, about 5 years ago, we had... do you have Shosan here?
No, not yet.
Yeah, we sort of Dharma question and answer. It's like formal, it's almost like formal Dokusan. And we had that with the abbot there. And I asked him a question coming back. And what I said was, returning to the United States with what I have learned here, what should I practice? And he was very quick. He just said, Shishobo. You know, without knowing any... I happen to have an affinity for this text. Without knowing what that affinity was, he said, this is what you should practice. So this is both the practice of a bodhisattva to help beings. It's also the practice by which we cultivate our bodhisattva nature. So it's how we become bodhisattvas by practicing this way, by how we become what at the core of things we already are, which is why I addressed you at the beginning is good evening, bodhisattvas. This was what one of the very early Zen teachers in the United States, Nyogen Senzaki, that's the way he used to address his community of lay people every night when he spoke to them, recognizing that they already were enlightening and enlightened beings and encouraging them. So that's the way I see this. So that's the bodhisattva part. The embracing part is very interesting. So think about that. So to embrace is to encircle when physically you do it. It's like I wrap my arms around you and you put your arms around me and we, in a sense, unify. We make one of what a moment before was two. Seen from the Buddha's point of view, one can't distinguish two separate beings or two separate things. There is just this embraced manifestation. So it's an act of unification. When you think about an embrace, when you think about it, this is like something that you do with your body, which all of us have done. In that moment of embrace, it's a little unclear where you end and the other person begins. Physically, you can't. I'm so in my skin right now, sitting here. I know where my separations are, but if I were to hug Taigen really closely, it wouldn't be so clear where that boundary was. So that's why I think that this word, the sho, that we translated as embrace, is tremendously evocative. And this is the act of unification of all beings. And yet we also maintain our individual energies, our karma, our activity. We are responsible for our practice. In this room, this is an interesting room, no windows. We sit around, we are embracing each other in this room. We create one organism in Zazen. This is really our style. Our style in the Soto school, and I think in the Zen school, is to come together and sit together and create one organism which is compounded of the many individualities and energies that we have, and yet it's also one, as seen from the Buddha looking through the walls at this room full of people. So I think that that's part of the process of being bodhisattva, this essence of embrace. So I know I don't have a lot of time, so I want to talk a little about these four embracing dharmas, and also just to say that I think that this original formulation in the Sangaha Sutta is very interesting, the foundations of social unity, because at least to my mind, this is perhaps as strong a social teaching as one finds in Dogen, which is not to say that his other teachings are not social, but certainly they're not primarily social for the most part. Occasionally they will allude to something, but this fascicle is all about relationship between people. It's also, I would say, and you know, you should go back and read it. And I'd be happy to send you my translation. I can send it via Taigen. But also the translation by Kaz Tanahashi and the translation by Tom Clear, very good. You know, these are just minor differences. But the way I see this, it moves, it talks about relationship, and then at the end, when it talks about identity action, it actually talks about relationship within a nation or a state. So it's talking about it from a political perspective. At the same time, one could view all of these teachings within this fascicle as talking about being in a unified, harmonized relationship with oneself and with one's body. Think about your body. You know, your body is made up. The nation of Alan, you know, there's like, you know, the province of my liver, you know, the state of my lung, the county of my small intestine. All of these have to work together harmoniously. They give to each other, they speak to each other, they act kindly to each other, and they act to create one whole organism. So you can think of this, you can think of this fascicle as a teaching in at the micro level, going up to the social level, and then actually going to a kind of national way of, or state way of looking at interdependence. So I just wanted to give you that kind of broad view, so you don't lock down on one way of thinking about this. So giving is dana. Traditionally, we give our attention, we give our friendship, we give material aid. Then as one progresses along a spiritual path, one gives the spiritual teachings, which is a very powerful gift, and you actually have to have some groundedness and understanding yourself to give that. And then finally, the highest gift is the gift of fearlessness. Fearlessness is traditionally the most precious gift that you can communicate to someone. If you think about, do any of you do hospice work? Which is fairly common, just to sit by the side of someone who is ill or dying, and somehow not to be afraid yourself. And in that fear and your ability to accept being in the presence of someone who is in a really extreme situation, you communicate fearlessness and ease to them. This is not a Buddhist thing. You know, it's not, it's a human thing. But it is a quality that we can cultivate. This is what Dogen is asking to do. He's asking to cultivate. So he says, and he talks about how you do it. In the beginning, he says, giving or offering means not being greedy. And then he goes to an interesting place. He says, not being greedy means not to covet. Not to covet commonly means not to flatter. It's like offering treasures we are about to discard to those we do not know. We give flowers blooming on the distant mountains to the Tathagata and offer treasures accumulated in past lives to living beings. So this is part of the spirit. It's, we give even what we don't own, but in a sense, we are those flowers on the blooming on the hillside, if we have an awareness of them, can we point people to that awareness, thereby allowing them to share in it, to share something that they would not otherwise see? And this goes with all these human qualities up to the quality of fearlessness. So giving begins with oneself. You know, I give myself to this practice, and then this practice offers itself to me. If I hide out in what I fear or what I desire or what I think that I want to accumulate for some sense of safety or for some sense of protection from the various forces outside my control, then I cut myself off from others, and I cut myself off from this deepest yearning that I might have. So I think that true giving means not hiding. And this, again, I think is a core experience of Zazen. We sit, we face the wall. It's not for nothing that we face the wall. Although we could have the same experience facing in. But we face the wall, we face this flow of mind, which is fine. And we recognize all of, you know, all of our emotions, all of our feelings, all of our petty thoughts, all of our most generous thoughts, all of them arising within Zazen, and we don't hide or turn away from that. So we give, I mean, there's a line I think in here, we give ourselves to ourselves and we give others to others. This is their practice. We give fearlessness also not by hiding. We give fearlessness by honestly being able to show others that we are willing to face our failures. We're willing to face failure and despair as a natural part of being completely alive. And that whatever we have of success or growth or development is only going to come, it's only going to come up through that channel. So it calls for, the fearlessness is rooted in honesty. It's honesty with ourselves and honesty with others. At the heart of these teachings is the understanding that giving is about making a connection. It's not about economics. If you read, there's this huge encyclopedic collection of practices called the path of perfection,
the path of purification,
the Visuddhimagga, and it has instructions for all these practices. And it's like when you have, there's a section there which tells you what to do when you're in conflict with somebody. And it goes through all these practices. You can do all these things you can do to kind of purify yourself and purify your feelings. And finally, when nothing works, it says, give a gift. And I think they mean literally, give something to that person. Not with any expectation that even that's going to immediately transform the conflict, but that giving, that act of you giving, sets in motion a chain of cause and effect that can be transformative. You got to take the long view. I've done this actually. I've done this in a couple of relationships where they just were completely stuck. But if you give something, and then you find 8 years later, all of a sudden, there's some shift in your relationship. There's a letting go in me, there's a letting go in the other person. This is also giving. So, the other thing I would say about giving, and I could, maybe this should have been the whole topic of this talk, there's a wonderful book, one of my favorite books. It's called The Gift by Lewis Hyde. Has anyone read it?
Yes.
It's a movie.
Maybe.
I don't. It's hard. It would be hard to make a movie of it. It's called The Gift. The Gift. The subtitle is The Erotic Life of Property. Somehow I don't think it's a movie. It'd be a very interesting movie. It'd be hard to write. But what he says at the beginning, which is really powerful to me, is a gift is only alive as it stays in circulation. So if I give a gift to you and you just hold on to it, then the energy of that gift will die, or sooner or later, it'll dissipate. But if the gift that I may give to you then turns into another gift that you give to someone else, and we keep this gift in circulation, then the energy is circulating among ourselves. And again, it's not an economic process. In Lewis Hyde's book, he describes sitting down at a family-style restaurant in France, the long wooden table, and sitting with strangers. And the practice was, as you do in Japanese tea, there would be bottles of wine on the table, and people would reach across the table and pour wine for each other. There is, you know, in economic or energetic mechanistic terms, there is no different energy being used in the overall conservation of energy, pouring the wine into your own glass as pouring for someone else. But in human terms, there is this connection. And that is what brings relationship to life. So I'm going to skip ahead because I want to talk a little about identity action and give a few minutes, give some time for discussion. Is that okay?
Yeah.
I'm skipping kind speech and beneficial action. All of these are forms of giving. This whole thing is giving. But I would also say this whole teaching, it's bracketed to me, giving on one end, and then identity action on the other. So identity action, Dogen says, the early Pali translation of this, the Pali word was samanatata, which is translated as cooperation, impartiality, consistency. And Dogen goes further. He says, identity action means not to be different, neither different from self nor different from others. How can you be different from yourself? We can come back. If you have an idea, I'd like to know.
We think we are.
But we're separated from ourselves.
Yeah.
We're different from ourselves, actually. This is what my wife is. This is her constant teaching to me. When I'm irritable or unhappy or whatever, she said, "Your problem right now is you want things to be different from how they are." It's like, oh yeah, right. Thank you very much. But she's right, you know, and it's, you know, after about 20 years, this is beginning to seep in, so that when I'm unhappy, I look just for that wedge of difference, you know, this wedge. I want things to be different from how they are. I want to be some other self in this moment. I want to be the happier self, you know. I want to be the self that doesn't have a sore throat or whatever. So identity action means not to be different, neither different for self nor different for others. For example, it is how, in the human world, the Tathagata identifies himself with human beings. Then, in Dogen language, because he identifies himself in the human world, we know that he must be the same in other worlds. When we realize identity action, self and others are one suchness. So, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin, has this mysterious quality of meeting each being in the form that they would recognize. So that they, first of all, so that they're at ease, they're fearless, but he meets each being in a very familiar, or she meets each being in a very familiar embodiment. And so you could say that Avalokiteshvara is a kind of mysterious shapeshifter, shifting shapes so that each being is being met as themselves. This is, I think, also something we can cultivate. How do we talk to people? You know, can we talk directly, honestly? Can we look them in the eye? So you're seeing a human being, they're seeing a human being. There's a marvelous set of videos of Suzuki Roshi. I think this was made for a TV program on KQED, educational TV, in the 60s in San Francisco. And there was no sound. They were driving to Tassajara and stopped at a gas station to get gas and food. And this is all pretty clear in the video. And there were these kind of shirtless hippies, very strong-looking young men, you know, no shirts, long hair, at the gas station, and they were kind of hanging around. I can't remember if they were pumping gas or not. And Suzuki Roshi, in his travel robes, gets out of the car and is walking around and just, like, walks right up to them and starts talking to them. And you can see, you can't hear anything, but you can see they're immediately in a real conversation. There is some energy that is transpiring between them. This is the quality that he had, from what I gather, because I never met him, but I know his son very well, of where when you were in his presence, you felt really seen. You felt like somebody was truly, truly seeing you down to the depth of your being. This, I think, is an aspiration to have. How can you do that? Not how can you be Suzuki Roshi, because you need to be you. This is also what Suzuki Roshi said. When you are you, Zen is Zen. But how can you be you in such a way that it is in full connection and identity with every sentient being that you meet? This is a challenge. I think this is the challenge of, if we're going to talk about in a social world, of activists, of organizers. It's the challenge of helping professionals. It's the challenge of practitioners. It's really a challenge of every one who wants to be fully alive and connected to our society and the people in it. In order to do that, you have to be, this is where Dogen's work is so wonderfully circular, you have to be in connection with yourself. You have to know what is going on internally. You have to take the time to examine that. You have to know, oh, am I anxious here? Am I unsettled? Where is my energy right now? My teacher, Sojourn Weitzman, a wonderful teaching to me was, he says, you should always know where your feet are. And he meant that quite literally. You know, where are your feet? You know, can you feel them? Are they on the ground? Are they supporting you? Can you put your attention there in that moment? And then, you know, from that place of literally being grounded, can you put your attention where it needs to be with another person? This is part of the act of identity action. So finally, Dogen moves to this meditation between a nation's people and their ruler. This is a very, I'm sure Taigen talks at some point about the sort of Confucian basis of Dogen's teachings. This is very Confucian, talking about a people and their ruler. I thought about this a lot during the last 8 years. And we can think about it now. Because mountains do not refuse to be mountains, they can be mountains and reach great heights. Because wise rulers do not weary of their people. They attract many people. Many people means a nation. A wise ruler may mean an emperor. Emperors do not weary of their people. This does not mean that they fail to offer rewards and punishments, but they never tire of their people. Because wise rulers are clear, they do not weary of their people. Although people always desire to form a nation and to find a wise ruler, few of them fully understand the reason why a wise ruler is wise. Therefore, they are simply glad to be embraced by a wise ruler. They don't realize that they themselves are embracing the wise ruler. Thus, the principle of identity action exists both in the wise ruler and ignorant people. It's an interesting teaching. And you, as I said, you can apply it in your Sangha. You can apply it in our nation. You can apply it to, are you the wise ruler? This is another saying of Suzuki Roshi's, was you be the boss of you. Not in a bossing around way, but it's like you are the ruler of, you know, this particular bodily territory. Are you ruling it wisely so that, you know, all the different precincts and states and counties are being treated properly so that they can then co-create the harmony of the whole body? So again, we're talking about this micro level to the macro level. These are intimately related to each other in this circle of life, this circle, again, the circle of giving. The people give their faith and trust to the ruler. The ruler is fully dependent upon that in order to rule. When that, in China, when, you know, they would have great disasters, they had a sense that, well, the ruler's mandate to rule has been revoked by the heavens. And it would be time to change. But in a sense, we get the rulers we deserve. And so we have to work in a way, in identity with people here in this room, in the city, throughout the world, to recognize that we are co-creating this world. And that's, I think that is the essence of identity action. I think I'm going to stop there because I'd like to leave some time for discussion. We have a few minutes, right?
Sure.
So, as I said, I can kind of go on and on about this, but I don't want to. So, and that, I'd like to hear what you have to say. So the floor is open. Yeah.
I really want to appreciate your translation. Using the word embracing, I've really enjoyed it. And I must confess that I didn't know that you were part of that translation with Shomaku, so thanks a lot.
Yeah, just of this. This is the only one that we've done together. There's a whole series of lectures that he's done on this. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was really fun to do that with him.
He made two analogies that I was really struck by.
Yeah.
And after you made the first one, I was too focused on that, I think, to fully appreciate the second one. So I was wondering if you could talk more about it. The first one was the statement you made about the mountains. Mountains are only mountains. Mountains can only grow at great heights by just being mountains. And then the second one was the symbiotic relationship between the people and the ruler, which I think is the more important one, which didn't really... I don't think I fully understand.
Right.
Talk a little more.
Sure. This is actually direct. These are direct quotations from the fascicle. Not my words. This is really such a typical way for Dogen to express himself. Because mountains do not refuse to be mountains, they can be mountains and reach great heights. In other words, they accept their nature. The nature of some, I mean really, the nature of some mountains are to be tall. It's as if, it's as if they had some function of will, which, you know, I think is metaphorical on his part. Some mountains are tall, rivers are rivers, they don't reject water. I think in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, which is another one, he uses this kind of language a lot. So our nature is to be the expression of all of the compounded elements that make us up.
Right.
I think that's the essence of what it means. Now, so then the next part, which was, I'm sorry, say again the
nation and the rulers.
Right. So what this is a kind of extended thing. He says, because wise rulers do not weary of their people, they attract many people.
Right. Yeah.
Was that where?
No, that part I see the connection.
Okay.
To the,
right. So which was the part where? Which was the other question then?
It was the last part where they talked about the fact that the people appreciated the wise ruler. But
yes. Okay. So that's my favorite part, actually. Although people always desire to form a nation, so let's not say nation. We're always forming social bodies of one kind or another. That's really built into, I think it's built into our mammalian nature. People always desire to form a nation to find a wise ruler. That's also perhaps hardwired into mammals, so that we could talk about that. Few of them fully understand the reason why a wise ruler is wise. Okay, let me read it then. Therefore, they are simply glad to be embraced by the wise ruler. They don't realize that they themselves are embracing a wise ruler. I think what this means is they don't realize that what they are giving to someone in some position of leadership is their collective wisdom and trust. Sometimes we don't realize that. We're so diverse and scattered, we don't realize that we're actually participating that in a way that frees a leader or ruler to be just and wise in a sense. And also, we don't realize the responsibility we have, say, to keep a leader honest. Because this is about identity action is about mutual accountability. And on the level of accountability, that's very horizontal. On the one hand, there may be a leader or there may be a teacher, but in the human-to-human level, that those beings are accountable to each other on a horizontal human-to-human level. And they are benefiting each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Great, thank you. Good question. Yes.
Along that line, I read that Suzuki Roshi once said, good teachers make good students, but good students also make good teachers. I wonder if that was...
Yeah, I mean, I think he also said, sometimes the teacher is the teacher and the student is the student. Sometimes the student is the teacher and the teacher is the student. What's the koan is it the man up the tree? Is it a Dumshan koan? I'm forgetting. There's a koan where the Zen teacher said essentially you know, if a child of five...
Oh, yes. Can, so the story is that there was a teacher famous for sitting up in a tree in all China, and this Su Dongbo, who was a great Zen adept and poet, came to visit him and asked his wisdom, and he said, it's a longer story, but he said, you look precarious up there, and the person sitting up in the tree said to Su Dongbo, who was like a governor of a province, you look precarious down there.
Right.
but then also he asked his wisdom, and he said, something very simple, like just to do good and not to cause harm.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And Su Dongbo said, well, everybody knows that. And the teacher said, everybody knows that, but can you do it? Something like that.
Right. I think it was like Su Dongbo said, even a child of five knows that. And he said, well, if a child of five knows that, then I will study with him. And if a man of 80 doesn't know it, then I will not study with him. And so it's interesting, you're looking at the same, also this mm-hmm. underneath this is the same dynamic. You have, you know, you have the leader, a political leader, trying to understand what is of benefit, what is the expression of wisdom.
I like the expression the wise leader doesn't grow tired of his people.
Yeah. Right.
He's always prepared to come meet the people, even figuratively, that there is no gap. You are intimately connected to everyone, and you have no choice but to meet them intimately. And you can't give up on that.
Right.
Entirely.
I think that's really good, and this is where this is a practice.
Yeah.
If those of you who are in leadership positions, and I'm sure that each of you is in one or another dimension of your life. There are times, and this goes back to my wife saying, you know, you're suffering because you want things to be different from how they are. It's like, sometimes it's like, enough already, you know. Why can't that person get over it? Or why can't they get off my case or whatever? You know, and how do you... How do you cultivate, as part of your practice, not turning away from even from people that are uncomfortable? And I think this is, I'm aware of the time, I think this is where I will, where I'd like to end, again, with a practice that I think derives from this. So this practice of constantly turning towards what is uncomfortable, what is inconvenient. I've experienced in the Sangha. I've lived there for 25 years in the same place, and our house is kind of like a fishbowl, and everybody tends to. And my wife is also just a wonderful practitioner, so it's people often bring their complaints and problems, and there are people who are really troubled in any community. You know, there are people who are ill, there are people who are just on the edge of, you know, being homeless, there are people with various psychological problems, and this practice of not tiring of them, it's manifested in a basically something that we've evolved, Lori and I have evolved as a practice, and it's something that sometimes you have to say. You know, you may be totally broke and feel desperate, and I may not be able to fix that. You know, but what I would say to you is, I will not abandon you. You know, I will be here to listen to you. You can call me up anytime. That I can offer. I may not be able to offer the material things that, not just that you think you need, but that you may actually need. But I will not turn away from you. And I'll tell you, you know what? It's not easy. Because sometimes I want to turn away. You know, sometimes a person may make me uncomfortable. Sometimes I feel like I don't have that capacity. Sometimes I can't bear the enormity of that suffering. But I think this is, these practices here, the practice of Zazen, the practice of actually being in relation to people, these are the ways that I try to learn how to do this. And I think that is the essence of the Bodhisattva vow, which is impossible. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Absolutely impossible and absolutely essential.